Well, why don't you also talk? I know you had, you've done a fair amount of work documenting mine disasters, and that mine disasters have played a role here in the history of the Anthracite region. Why don't you talk a little bit about your about your work in relation to those?
Yeah, well, you know, as everyone's aware, but coal mining was a pretty dangerous occupation, especially in the early days. You had men going into the mines, using oil lamps and carbide lamps, open flame lamps, and all, and to see what they were doing. Just, there was no other light down there. And, but through the years, there have been a lot of mine disasters, you know, huge ones, like the one up at Avondale, and I think in 1869, there was 122 killed there. And the twin shaft at Pittston in 1896, it's like 20, 30 years later, 58 were killed. And then the Baltimore Tunnel explosion in 1919, right after the First World War, 94 were killed. And through the years, there have been numerous, you know, whether 8, 10, 12, Jeansville, the floodings, and through the years, there have been a number of explosions, fall-ins, fires. And I wouldn't say fortunate, but I was able to, in my time, I was able to cover three of them, maybe photograph three of them. And the, I guess the first one was up at the Knox Mine disaster up at Pittston, when 12 were killed, when the Susquehanna River broke through. The miners just got a little bit too close. The roof got a little bit close to the Susquehanna River, and the river broke through, and it was in January of 1959. I heard about it on the radio, and it was another one of those things. I don't know why you go to them, but you're part of the region. In 59, it was just about 4 or 5 years, about 4 years after the mines closed here, you know. But they were still working up at the Wilkes-Barre. Deep mining was still operating up there. But after the river went through, and that was the end of the deep mining in the Wyoming Valley. There was no... I don't have too many pictures of that, because by the time I got up there, I don't have any pictures of any of the men being brought out. You know, that was done. But I have a few photographs showing the town and the people waiting to see what's going to happen. I have numerous pictures of people dropping in huge railroad gondolas to try to breach this hole in the Susquehanna. That was kind of an eerie scene with the ice flowing down the river, and then all this river is just swallowing up these huge mine gondolas. And then I got the shaft, you know, and the people walking past the shaft carrying their children and all that. But that was about the first one I covered.
That really is such a historic connection, because I know, I'm pretty sure that Harper's back in the 1860s would have done drawings at the time of Avondale. Yeah. And they would have shown the distressed wives of miners waiting to hear what would happen. I mean, that is you do it in 1959. There's a 100-year tradition in this region of these mine disasters and of the family anxiously awaiting what will, and it was something that goes way back and is so elemental to the life of a mining town.
But there's so few photographs available of these disasters. Every now and then you'll run across one, and somebody will print it in a newspaper, something, have an issue coming out or something, and they'll run across. But there's so few photographs in the Anthracite that were made in the Anthracite region. I don't know if somebody, like you mentioned, Harper's or something, whether this was big enough for them or something like that. You would think so. I mean, maybe there was other things that they thought were more important or something like that. I don't know. wasn't the Civil War, naturally, you know. But the Civil War was about 1870s, 60s, and if it wasn't for people like Matthew Brady and Gardner and all that, we wouldn't have pictures of the Civil War, probably. Well, we would, but not as many. But whether people wanted to come into the coal regions and photograph, I don't know. They would. We run across these old photographs. You have the miners out in front of the mine tunnel or something like that, and they probably did those to probably sell them. Whether they were going to be used for any publication, I doubt it.
You don't sense that the Anthracite region had that much appeal to outsiders?
I don't think so. No, I don't think.
To rather major figures in the history of photography.
That was the primary reason why the Redding Company hired Bretz to do the inside mine photographs, because I think that was in 1884 or 5, around there. I think there was an exposition coming up in New Orleans in 1889, I believe, and they wanted to show people what a coal mine looked like and how they mine coal, and that's why they brought in DC generators from St. Louis to light up the inside of a mine. Spent a lot of money, but I imagine after they got through with those pictures that they used for the exposition, that was it for probably the next, God only knows when, next 100 years.
Yeah.
And I think they just did it for promotional purposes too. Which goes back to what I started as to do promotional photographs for the LCNN in the 50s. Yeah.
By the way, one of the things I photocopied yesterday when I was working at the Earth Conservancy were annual reports of the Glenn Alden Company. And there were a couple of years that had particularly good photographs.
Did they?
I think 1951 was interesting. That for some reason they had obviously sent their photographer into the mines and around the breaker and the railroad yards, and there were quite a few good photos and it reminded me, of what you said about your own work, that I'm going to look.
These are printed ones. These are
printed in their annual report.
Okay.
Similar to what you of your work is printed in the LCNN.
We wonder where the originals are.
That's a good question, because I was, I'm working in the papers of the Glenn Alden Company.
Yeah.
We have all their mine maps, which are crucial, the engineering maps that are so important.
Yeah.
But I haven't heard from anybody that there are any, glass plate negatives or plastic negatives or anything like that in this collection.
Yeah. It's strange because I guess maybe about 10, 12 years ago, there was a fellow named John Beck, I think his name was, doing this history of Scranton. Doing his history of Scranton, and one day I got a call, and he said he'd like to use some of my photographs. I said, "Well, I don't have any of Scranton." I said, most of mine were done in the southern coal field." I said, "I have nothing of Scranton." And he said, "Well, that's all right." He said, "Coal mines are coal mines, you know." And I said, "Well," I said, "I don't know." I said, "Can't you find photographs of interior scenes around the Scranton area?" And he said, "Well," he tried and he couldn't find any. I said, "Well, if you want to use them," and he sent me the book, and sure enough, he used a whole chapter of Scranton, but he used the Panther Valley mines.
He should have a little better sense than that. I mean, since that book's come out, Chester Kalesa, I think, has done work on Horgan. Horgan was a Delaware and Hudson person.
Right, yeah.
That's the Scranton area.
He looked, and the reason it was about the time I had the exhibit in Scranton, and I guess it was, he saw the photographs, and I guess he thought, well, this is a good way to just add, and he had about 6 or 7 pages in there, and he had Panther Valley miners in there,
Did he at least identify them in the book
as
Panther Valley?
Oh, yeah. And he said, "Coal miners are coal miners."
That's a shame, because obviously there were considerable differences. When you read about Glenn Alden, Glenn Alden in its last years appears to have made a pretty successful effort to use mechanical mining machines.
Right. Yeah. Because their veins were flat.
Exactly, but around
Valley miners are on a pinch. You can't use a machine.
So that you wouldn't have had the kind of mining techniques used
in
Scranton that you had used here.
Oh, no.
So when you demonstrate the miners at the breast, or when you demonstrate the way a chute operates, they would probably have some sort of a continuous conveyor, would have been the way they got the coal.
Mining here is very unique, I mean, as far as... there's no way you can get any type of machine. I mean, you get an air drill up there or something like
You're
that.
You're doing fine.
Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah. Well, what about Shepton? That was one where I've seen some of your photographs of the Shepton disaster.
The Shepton disaster was probably the most photographed and watched disaster in the Anthracite region. I mean, due to the fact that television was coming into its own there, as it, they were covering it as a big news events and all that. And it was covered by every network and every newspaper in the East here. You know, even foreign press was here.
Now, this is August 63, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How did you hear about this?
I heard about it on the radio. I heard that there was three miners entombed. I was working for Bethlehem Steel at the time. Did I say 63?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was working for Bethlehem Steel at the time, and it was I think it was a Tuesday or something. I think I was off that week, or I had a day off or something, and I heard about it, and I decided, well, Shepton's not that far from Lansford. You know, you go up 309 up to Hazleton, branch off through West Hazleton, and Shepton's about, what, 3-4 miles down the road. I figured it's not that far. And when I got up there, lo and behold, who do I see but Gordon Smith, who was the chief mine inspector who was handling the whole job. I had photographed Gordon Smith many years ago. He was kind of the foreman of the superintendent of the Gilbert & Coal Company up at Gilbert. So we became pretty good friends, you know, through the photographs and all that. And I had, when I got up there, I had to speak graphic, and they were trying to send some mines down the slope and all that, and they would go down part way, they had to come back up because there were the gash, you know, and then they reported that it was the mine was pretty well blocked up and all that. And then I think I went up the next day, and then Gordon told me, he said, I don't think we'll ever find Louis Bova. Kind of talked to him and not insisted, but felt that they should drill a hole that's one place, you know, this one area and all that, because he had a pretty good idea of what the mine looked like and where they might be. And I think it was a Saturday, and they decided to build, to drill a 6-inch borehole and all that. And after they got down to about where they thought the mine is, I think they were only down like 300 feet or something like that. I think they got down there, and then they dropped this pipe down into this borehole, and lo and behold, the fella, I forget his name, Biros, I think his name was, who hauled her down, and he heard a noise, and he got all excited and said, hey, they're alive. The men are alive. So
the brother of the miner was saying to people, if I'd been trapped under there, this is a place where I could have gone to.
Right.
The assumption is that actually the mine is blocked, but the men that aren't necessarily there where the blockage occurred. So they weren't necessarily...
I think Dave Fellin was 58, and I think Louis Bova was 54, and then Henry Throne, who had just worked there a few days, was 28. When they got trapped... The mine hadn't caved in all the way, and Louis Bova thought that he could escape somehow, so he took off, you know, and that's how he got separated from the other two. And they were, well, the first 6 days they were down there, of course, they ran out of, first they ran out of light, you know, and they were, you know, their lights went dead on them and all that, and they were in complete darkness, and they were they were in a space maybe about 6 foot long and maybe about 4 foot wide or something, very narrow place. And some timbers had come down and all that was kind of bracing them, you know, so nothing else would come down on top of them. And so they were in a very confined space. And when when the word come out that the miners were alive, well, this spread like wildfire, you know.
This was about a week after the actual...
6 days. 6 days. Yeah, and after, this spread like wildfire, and the first thing you know, everybody converged on Shepton. I called Life magazine. I knew Ruth Lester, who was head of the Freelancers and Stringers and all that. I called her. I said, Ruth, there's a big story breaking down here. I said, there's three miners down here, and I said, been into them 6 days, and I said, they found them alive. He said, go on up and cover it. So I went up. A couple of days later, they sent a Life photographer and a reporter down. The Life photographer's name was Gray Vallette, and the reporter was a guy named Apollock. I forget his first name. And but we covered them for continually from then to the day they were brought up. I learned a lot, like everything else. I was up there every day. I took all my vacation time from Bethlehem Steel. Every day I'd call my boss, Orland. I said, Orland, I can't make it today. I'm still up here. He was getting a little rambunctious. And he said, when are you coming back? I said, I'm not yet, you know. And finally I covered it for life. We, every night they would pick up our film, bring in a helicopter, pick up the film, fly it to New York City, and they would develop it and all that. And I never thought too much about it, but I thought, oh goodness, I'm going to shoot all these pictures and all that, and I said, I'm never going to see them, you know. And that was the only thing that I was, I kind of felt bad about it, because I think I would rather not been paid by Life, you know, the $150 a day, but I'd rather have the negatives. It would be more important to me. But about 2 years after the disaster, I got a big box in the mail, and they send every negative and every color transparency back to me. Yeah, so I have those now. So.
How many did they finally print?
I think they just used one of mine. I think they only printed about three or four pictures or something. But they were noted for that. I mean, if a story broke and something took precedence, they just cut it, you know. I mean, it was that was the big gripe of. I talked to Gray a lot of many times, at, you know, up at the Hotel Aldemont at night and all that, and that was their biggest. They would go out and shoot stories for months, and it wouldn't run, you know. That would just completely not run. And but that's the way Life shot things. They had photographers. So many photographers all over the world shooting, and then only had one magazine coming out.
What are the photos you remember from that particular work that you particularly proud of, or you think captured something that you wanted to communicate to people?
Oh, I think most of the ones I really like are the ones of like Mrs. Sloan, Mrs. Fallon, and all that, going through this anxiety of. Wondering whether, you know, she would see her husband anymore, and being consoled by, you know, a priest or a sister, or there actually wasn't that much more. Everything was underground, which we had no control over, you know. Plus the fact of all the people who got involved, like the Navy people, who they were very interested in how people survive underground, you know, for 14 days. So they had big teams of medical people up here and all that. They brought in cameras too, you know, the cameras that they could drop down after they enlarged the hole. They could drop a camera down and see under, you know, this was all revolutionary in those days. And of course then the night that we're going to bring them out, it was like a circus up there. I mean, there was lights. I mean, this was like a city. Everything was lit up. So Greg told me, he said, George, he says, no sense of both of us being down. He said, why don't you go up to the hospital? When they bring the men in, she said, we'll get some shots up at the hospital. So I said, all right. So I got in the car, drove up, and of course the state cop stopped me, and he said, where are you going? I said, well, I said, I'm working for Life magazine, and I said, I want to get into the hospital. He said, follow me. They carried an awful lot of weight. So he took me all the way up through past everybody and sat me right in front of the big network cameras. And when they hauled the two men down the aisle, on stretchers and all that, I was able to get those photographs in. And that was a big event. I doubt whether we'll ever see an event in the Anthracite region that will be covered like that again. It's not so much that there were so many men killed, it's that they were down so long and they were alive, and they were drilling these holes bigger and bigger so that eventually they would be big enough to squeeze them out. You know, they put harnesses around them and all that, and then lift them out of there, you know. So it was, and they had to figure out different harness, different, they tried different things, and so I imagine they, all these survival people learned a lot too there, and they were all over, and of course the Union people were there, you know, the Tony Boyle, and the so it was,
Did they ever have something of an investigation and determine what had caused the cave-in? Was that also part, or is it?
It wasn't an explosion. It was just a fall. It probably weak timbers or something like that. Yeah, it wasn't an explosion. No.
And it wasn't a cave-in actually in an area where they were working. It was
no. It was no. It was away from them, but they couldn't get out anymore. I mean, they were there. I think it was right after that is when the state demanded that every bootleg mine have a second escapeway. And I think that's what caused it, because I think if they would have had a second escapeway, you know, they could have got out.
This was a tiny operation, this?
What's that?
This mine was just a tiny...
Oh, yeah, there was only four people. It was a man who was hoisting the cars, a guy named a Walker, and the three men, that's all. And it was very, very crude tipples, you know, and very small... slope, you know, the cars that take the coal out were very small. No, it was very small, yeah. But Felon was a miner all his life, and this was in his blood. And he seemed to think that Henry Thrawn even said it wasn't for Dave, he would never have made it. You know, that he pulled him through on it, because he was. You work in a mine of, I don't know how many weeks or something, whatever it was, and then all of a sudden you get trapped, you know, and you're 28 years old. It's a whole different...
It is sort of interesting that a 28-year-old in 1963 would have been working in the mines.
Yes, yeah.
Because the most younger people weren't following the older.
There's still young people, you know, like guys like Greg Yerchak here down here. He's, you know, he's what, in his 30s, I guess, and he's in... he works in a mine every day. He's still, a lot of these bootleg mines, they feel now that they could make more money on being their own boss, you know, and then going to work in some factory or whatever. So they continue opening up these little slopes and make a living out of it.
I mean, like the couple of people in Minersville.
Yes.
Where I went into that mine.
And from, say, Kamakwa, Pottsville, all those little towns, Mary D., Kumbola, Tuscarora, and all that. There's little bootleg mines, Dodger, all that, on the north side of the mountain there. Yeah, the north side of the mountain, yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, tell me about the Tower City disaster, because that's not one that I really know about. You mentioned that as being the last one you thought you covered.
Let's see, the Tower City, let me get the date on that right. Yeah, Tower City, that was in March of 1977. It was kind of a day almost like Knox, not quite as cold. It was, of course, it was March, but it was that was caused by a flooding also. But what happened there, evidently some water had built up in the dam in one of the old workings or something like that, and then when the men went into the gangway and all that, the water, instead of breaking in from the ceiling, broke in from the bottom and flooded it flooded the mine out, and I heard about that too on, you know, on the radio, you hear things, and I decided to go up there and spent a number of days while they were trying to get the men out, you know, and then they did locate a fellow by the name of Adley, Robert Adley. They did locate him. Evidently, he got up into an air pocket or something where the water hadn't gotten, and he was able to have enough air up there to survive. And they did locate him. And they were every day they would go in with different crews and all that to try to clear enough, I guess, garbage and all that, you know, debris and all that to get them out. And we were staying up in an old trailer. The state brought us a trailer in, and that's where we were sleeping on the floor there. And this one morning they said they were going to bring them out at 9 o'clock in the morning. So when you're in it, sleeping in a trailer and all that, you don't get to sleep much and all that. So I got up early with another fellow photographer. We were standing by the tunnel mouth, and we see these lights coming toward us. And you know, they're getting bigger and bigger, and all of a sudden he decided, sadly decided, he didn't want to be carried out. He wanted to walk out, and he walked out of there. So we were able to photograph them coming out, you know.
So the lights you were seeing were lights that were...
lights of miners.
Yes,
who were
yes.
coming up through
right.
the tunnel.
Work.
Yeah.
And there wasn't much to show either. All you could do is show the people going into the mines, the rescue workers, and try to get good character studies of their faces and their anxieties and, you know, and what else can you show with something like that?
Was there a similar vigil there as there had been in Shepton?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And Port Griffith?
Yes, but not as big, not as great. Shepton was unique, unique. The Red Cross was up there in the Salvation Army and different newsy people and all that. But
how many people were trapped at Tower City? Do you remember?
I think it was nine. I think there was nine, I think, and then I think eight were drowned, you know, they were killed, I believe.
Is that sort of your last major mine disaster in the Anthracite region?
Yeah, there had been some smaller ones. You know, one or two was killed or somebody by a piece of machinery or fall or something like that, but... I think that was the last major disaster or something, sort of we call it disaster in the region.
With the kind of drama of waiting to see if people would be rescued and whatnot.
Yeah, you know, where you have the relatives and the family waiting and waiting and waiting, you know, and you could just shoot so much of the, you know, you can't start poking your camera in their faces too often. You got to give them a little privacy and all that, so you have to be very careful with what you're doing. That was the last one.
Yeah.
But one nice thing about it, I do have a little record of the three of them, photographically. They're not great pictures and all that, but they are a record of that disaster. So, you know, it's something.
That's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, good.